This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have talked to a number of the people here in Northwest Indiana who are interested in succeeding Congressman Pete Visclosky in Congress in Washington, D.C. And we have another here in the studio to talk about his candidacy. Ryan Farrar is with us. Ryan, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take a moment, talk about yourself, your interest being a native of the region, and in particular, the fact that you're not a complete political newcomer. You have run for public office before, and what did that experience, along with everything else that you've experienced in your neighborhood, so to speak, in South Lake County, got you interested in now deciding to run for Congress?
Yeah, so I'm 39 years old. I've effectively, I say I've lived in the first district my whole life. That's technically not true at the moment because the lines were redrawn after the last census. I'm actually about a mile outside, but you know, I've been, like I said, I was born, my parents met in East Gary, and lived my whole life in this culture and community. So even though I'm on the outside of the boundary, I'm totally eligible to run for this seat. It's, you know, I've been voting for Pete Visclosky since I was 18. So I've always kind of dreamed of replacing him. But yeah, I ran for state Senate in 2018. It was a really hard race. If you know State Senate District 6, which does cover the south half of Lake County, it's very Republican. And I was actually very proud of the results, even though we didn't win. You know, I got almost 19,000 votes, about 37% of the vote. May not sound like huge returns, but if you look at the history of Democrats running in that district, it's the best returns ever a Democrat has ever had running there. So,
did that opportunity and running for state Senate, even though you didn't win the race, did that give you at least the idea that maybe you could go on for bigger and better things?
Absolutely. You know, it was, in a way, I kind of look at that as it was almost a test run, like a learning experience. And I learned so much that I'm already using as I've launched this campaign. I've made a lot of connections, just learned how to do things, you know, little things I overlooked back then, like just putting out a press release and making all those proper contacts. That was a rough transition back then because I was still working for the state. You know, I worked for the Department of Child Services, and because of some of my cases kind of running long, I didn't want to back out of that position before I started campaigning, but I needed to start campaigning. So I kind of got a late start on that. So I've learned those lessons, and I haven't fallen into those same kind of pitfalls this time around.
In planning for this campaign, which is, it was going to be a pretty strenuous one, you've got three counties to cover, basically Lake and Border and LaPorte, make up the first congressional district. You focused in, I guess, not only on the issues that all the other candidates have mentioned so far, but you bring up one big important issue that hasn't been brought up that you feel should be addressed as a progressive Democrat, and that's the issue of campaign reform. What got you first to think about that idea, and how do you think that is going to fit into the campaign that you're going to be running for now going up to the primary election?
Yeah, it's actually been something that has been on my radar for a long time. You know, the thing that first drew me into politics was as a young man experiencing the 2000 election, feeling like democracy was under attack, you know, seeing somebody get elected who didn't get the most votes at the presidential level. That kind of disturbed me. So, you know, I was just working in a factory then as a young man, and I actually got laid off. My factory moved south of the border, largely because of the NAFTA trade agreement. So that presented an opportunity for me to go to college. I majored in political science, and I was always looking for what's the thing that can fix politics? What's the thing that's going to make representatives work for the people more and reflect our interests? And it just became increasingly obvious to me that the problem is the corrupting influence of money. You know, we talked a lot in the last election about foreign campaign interference. Election interference. And of course, that's a serious issue as well. But under our Citizens United, we allow pretty much any corporation, any billionaire to have unlimited influence. You know, they can launch these super PACs, they can funnel millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases into these super PACs. And it's just an unfair amount of speech that they get. So, and moreover, when you look at how much money the candidates themselves get from corporations, it's really disturbing. What I like to say is, if we're going to reform climate change, our healthcare system, criminal justice system, we can't have candidates that are getting more money from the fossil fuel industry, from private prisons, from the healthcare and the insurance industry, because when they're getting more money from those entities than they get in a congressional salary, well, who are they really working for? So that's something that, you know, I'd love to go to Washington and bring that fight there. Obviously, that's the ultimate goal. But even if I can't do that, I'm going to use this election, this campaign, to bring awareness to this issue. So to me, that, you know, it makes me feel like I'm fighting the good fight. Even if I don't get to go fight the fight in Washington, I'm going to keep pushing for transparency and accountability in this campaign.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the issues that have been brought up, and some of them are related to what you've just mentioned about the importance to look into serious campaign reform. And some are related in a way because you've had experiences personally here in Northwest Indiana. One in particular is immigration, the immigration issue that is foremost to many people in Northwest Indiana. And you were able to fight it in a way back in 2018 when the GEO Group was very interested in locating a facility here in Northwest Indiana. And tell us about that and what you learned from that experience.
Yeah, it was a weird coincidence. You know, I was already running. I had just won the primary in the contest. And almost the very next day, actually it was that evening, the evening of the primary, I was contacted by some allies in Northwest Indiana, a lot of the people that were instrumental in keeping GEO Group out of the northern part of Lake County about a proposal for Newton County, which, like I said, I live at the very northern edge of Newton County. So I looked into it, and by coincidence, I found that there was a recent rezoning, which I was well aware of because it was within a few hundred feet or yards of my house. So it looked like that spot was being primed for the potential detention center, and I just felt like action needed to be taken. So I worked with a lot of allies up this way. I know a lot of people, especially running for office, they try to distance themselves from activist groups, but I was looking for all the help I can get. So I talked to people within Northwest Indiana Resistance, Black Lives Matter, anybody who was willing to give me advice and assistance in how to fight this thing. And we developed a strategy to pressure the public officials, let them know we didn't want it, let them know we needed some assurances that it wasn't going to happen. And they were very resistant because if you're running a county, you realize having something like that in your county, it is going to generate revenue. And, you know, a lot of our public officials down there are more concerned with Kentland than they are Roselawn. So it was a big fight, but we kept the pressure on. We kept attending commissioners' meetings, letting them know how we felt. And in time, I think we made the issue toxic enough for them that they gave in, and they sent a letter to GEO Group and basically told them, you know, we're not going to support you coming to Newton County. And I consider that a huge accomplishment.
What are your thoughts about the issue of economic development? And you look at it too, I understand, from a pro-labor point of view, rather than just simply building more opportunities for more businesses and industries in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah. The way I look at it, you know, and I agree with, there does need to be a raise of the minimum wage. I would argue that it's not necessarily it needs to be 15. I think we need a market-based minimum wage that is reflective of economic factors, GDP, et cetera, so we can have the right minimum wage in the right area, because all 50 states have different factors going on in that regard. But overall, I think the true key to increasing wages for more prosperity for the middle and the lower working class is union rights. You know, since the 1980s, union rights have been getting attacked and eroded. You know, I see no reason that there should be such a thing as right to work laws. They really only exist to allow people to be able to opt out of paying their union membership, which weakens the strength of the union. And in time, that union gets so weak that they just get run over when it comes time to do the collective bargaining. And another thing I see is, you know, CEO pay often being so outrageously high. And I think that the membership, the workers of a company, ought to have a say themselves in how much the people at the top of their corporation make. I mean, how much more valuable than the rank and file are they? So, you know, that's money that should perhaps be put into profit sharing, perhaps investment in the company. So these are just, you know, the very tip of the iceberg in terms of trying to get more wages in the pockets of the people, which is ultimately what's really going to turn the economy around. So when people have that expendable income, that's when you see a real economic boom.
I know that even though it's not a key campaign plank for you, the environment is important to you, and you've experienced that in your own neighborhood, I understand. Is that particularly close experience what has gotten you into adding that in your thought of running for Congress?
To some degree, it's another one of those things that almost happened by chance. You know, 6 or 7 years ago, I was going through a career change, and sort of just in a mode of trying to find myself, I became an outdoorsman for a while. I was able to just take some time and focus on fishing. And I got so into fishing, I was virtually a climate scientist because I wasn't just doing it to do it. Like, I wanted the best experience as possible. I was studying water conditions, weather conditions, following moon phases, and being out in the outdoors almost every day. So it really gave me a chance to connect with nature, but also to observe what was happening and just seeing, our streams and rivers were just not as healthy as I thought they would be. A lot of times the conditions should have been great for fishing, and fish just wouldn't be biting. And you see, a lot of contamination, pollution, a lot of it coming from field runoff, quite frankly. But it all, it all really brought me back around to the science of climate change, which at the time, under the Obama administration, we kind of felt like we were going to get it right. When you look at all the things we've accomplished in terms of technology in this country, you would think that there would be a priority, to keeping the planet healthy. But now it looks like we're just not headed in the right direction. So, I have a lot of ideas for that as well. I was just thinking last night, just in terms of cars, we burn a lot of gas. What can we do about it? Well, we have electric cars. The technology is already there. But, I think a big part of the problem is they're not appealing to the consumers with the vehicles. A lot of people like to drive SUVs. They like to drive trucks. So when it comes time to buy a new vehicle, there's not a good electric option on the market. So I like to think that, if I'm in Congress, I can fight to put some incentives for the car industry to start producing the vehicles that people might want to switch over to electric, so that, I think, if we do this right, that within 10 years, people who, they have their basic commuter vehicles, they could replace those vehicles when they look for a new vehicle with an electric version, and maybe get anywhere from 50 to 75% of the gas-powered vehicles replaced with electric ones. Now, that wouldn't in itself solve climate change. A lot more has to be done, but it's something.
Now, you've got your campaign started here as we wrap up 2019. You're looking to 2020, and that's, of course, going to be the real work. You'll have until the elections in May to get out there and visit Northwest Indiana. Any thoughts about how you're going to get your campaign underway as the new year gets underway, and in turn, how you're going to keep it as strong as you can up until Election Day?
Yeah, for me, I've decided I'm going to really, really push social media. I'm on pretty much every platform right now. I got a Facebook, I got a Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr. Whatever I can do to bring some eyeballs onto the campaign, I'm going to do. Obviously got a lot of appearances already booked. There's going to be a town hall sponsored by Indivisible that's going to be taking place on the 16th at the Maryville Lake County Public Library.
That's right.
And then just a couple days later, the Porter and Lake Young Democrats are sponsoring the first debate of the primary season at the same public library there in Maryville. So I'm really excited, especially for the debate, to be able to just stand toe-to-toe with all the other candidates on stage and, show the difference between us. Right now, I think a lot of us are saying similar things. I'm trying to stand out and really put campaign finance reform forward because I believe that's the issue that obstructs all other issues. But it seems like generally you hear the Democrats talk and it's like, yeah, we want to get you health care. We want to fight climate change and we're pro-union. And so being able to stand toe-to-toe and we're like really dig in and point out our differences is something I think is going to be huge for the voters.
Well, Ryan, sounds like you have quite a lot of work ahead, and we appreciate you spending time and talking about your campaign as it's getting underway now, and I hope to have a chance to talk with you and catch you on some of these other campaign stops in the weeks and the months ahead before the May primary elections. Thank you for joining us today.
If I could make one last little plug, I'm going to be putting on what I'm calling a Very Vote for Our Christmas special. It's going to go up on my social media sometime tomorrow. And what I'm going to be doing is sitting down with my acoustic guitar. So I'm also a musician. I'm going to play some Christmas songs. It's going to be my way of just wishing everyone a Merry Christmas and saying thank you to everybody who's been supporting my campaign. And I think it's just a fun way. Hopefully I can get some new eyeballs on our campaign. So I'm really looking forward to that. But thanks for having me.
Ryan, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it. Ryan Farrar is one of the latest candidates running for Congress as Pete Viscoski has chosen not to run for another term of office. And there's quite a field already developing for the May primary election on the Democratic Party. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana Landmarks has a new online guide that is going to showcase the home styles over 200 years. In fact, if you get the Indiana Preservation magazine from Indiana Landmarks, you get a chance to check out a few of them here, but we'll find out more in particular. Let's talk to Suzanne Stannis. She is the Indiana Landmarks Director of Heritage Education and Information, and thanks for being with us on the show today.
Thank you, Chris.
Tell us first how this online guide got started.
Well, we decided that we wanted to do something that was very visual because we had had an old-style guide that was printed that just had line drawings that was done well before probably even the invention of the Internet. And we decided with this, you know, newfangled technology, we could put a lot of photographs of Indiana examples. And then eventually our goal is to be able to have people submit their own photos, likely through Instagram, and we can continue to build that database.
How do you think it was back in the 1950s or so, or maybe even earlier, when that printed guide was first issued?
Oh, no, it wasn't really that early, but okay. I think we started it in the 1980s, and then, you know, kind of had various incarnations of it. But the problem was it only showed line drawings, and in often cases it only showed one example. And the thing with architectural design is that there are so many variations on each style that it's really hard to show one drawing and say, this is what they should all look like.
I guess this also probably didn't take into place what might be considered, at least back then, even back in the 80s, some of the home styles that went back even before then. Like back during World War II, when you talk about the Lustrun homes and the homes that Sears Roebuck used to have their plans on in the catalog.
Yeah, we really added a lot of styles, including those, you know, as you said, post-World War II. And the other thing that we've done that we feel is different than a lot of existing online and printed style guides is we've tried to include vernacular styles. And those are defined as houses that are, you know, typically built by builders or taken out of pattern books or represent particular regional styles. And they're really what most of us live in. And you'll find that the majority of style guides feature what we call high styles. And those are the things that are architect designed and, you know, quite elaborate. So we tried to put a lot more information into those vernacular styles. And for example, when we did that first printed guide, we listed a lot of things as just carpenter builder. As just, you know, that's what these simple styles were. And we've since been able to go back and work with folklorists and come up with specific names for each of those styles based upon the shape of the building. So you get the T plan and the L plan and gable front and that sort of thing. The other improvement that has been made since we did the old printed guide is so much more research has been done on the mid-20th century styles. Mm-hmm. For so long, we just, again, lumped all those into contemporary, like we did with Carpenter Builder. And there's been a lot of scholarly research on, again, trying to break those down into subcategories and give those more accurate names.
I understand that you all did a lot on so much research on this that you were able to put into the online guide a way for anybody that goes on to Indiana Landmarks website and looks this up to find out really a bit of history, a lot of history, actually, maybe I should say. You can learn a lot about how we lived in Indiana by the home designs and how a home was built back then. What were some of the things that you all noted, we'll say, from the time from Victorian style homes to today?
Yeah, and I think that's what really makes the study of architecture more interesting. You know, we're not just looking at details and what makes something Italianate, but we're looking at why was the style popular when it was. And so that's the sort of thing that we have included with this online guide. And say, for example, looking at, you know, the Victorian era, the Queen Anne houses were really highly decorated on the inside. They would have wall-to-wall carpets. People would often have, like, animal skins on the floors. They might have all sorts of, you know, just little knickknacks sitting around. And then as people started to understand the germ theory towards the end of the 19th century, they realized that germs are what make people sick. And so we see the craftsman style becoming very popular in the early 20th century, the late 19th century, and people are getting rid of a lot of that heavy interior decoration. And they're even making some built-in furniture. If people have a house from that period, they may have built-in bookcases or a built-in sideboard in the dining room and hardwood floors, and then even sleeping porches, which I find fascinating. You know, they thought that, okay, getting outside, getting fresh air was going to make you healthier. So people would actually sleep outside on these sleeping porches, often even in the cold weather.
Did that kind of lend to the development eventually of screened-in porches?
That's a good question that I honestly I don't know the answer to. I'm sure that it must have at some point because, yeah, those early sleeping porches often would have wooden louvers, and so they weren't necessarily screened. But, yeah, good question. I've got, and that's something we could add to that website. And the beauty of the website is you can change it, that we should look into the history of technology of metal screens.
Also, too, when you were putting together the online guide, did you have an opportunity to, again, as part of history, to compare what some of the architects had looked at, maybe as they grew up, as they were being trained? They may have looked at maybe the Bauhaus designs, especially some of these homes that were the architects of fashion furniture that goes along specifically with the type of home.
Yeah, exactly. And you definitely start to see that with the mid-century modern styles. And Frank Lloyd Wright is a perfect example of that. In the houses that he designed for clients, he often designed the furniture. He went so far as to, in a couple of cases, design clothing that he thought the woman of the house should wear. So I don't know that anybody else has gone quite as far as Frank Lloyd Wright, but we do see architects that are designing furniture that will fit in that style of house. So it may not be that they designed it for a specific house, but this is what they recommend, you know, in that type of house.
Are you finding that having the online guide available by folks that go onto the Indiana Landmarks website goes along very well to people that manage to take the tours? For example, like folks that check out the Century of Progress homes up here in Northwest Indiana, when the homes are up for display to the public, once a year, you have a chance to take a look at these homes, and it kind of goes back to the Logs to Lestrens tour that's been held. You get a chance to make the comparison with types of homes back in the early 20th century, going all the way up through now.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can go back and look at our website and see why were log houses built when they were and how were they changed. And the Logs to Lestrens tour is a perfect example because we have a log house on that tour that actually had been covered in siding and removed. And so the style guide talks about, you know, why were things covered in siding and as well as the history behind the Lestrens. So, you know, you'll likely get that information on the tour, but if you forget or you want to share it with anybody, you can easily go back to our website and check out those sections.
Now, I know we've just kind of mentioned it briefly here about how you can find this online guide. Specifically, how can you find this new online guide to home styles over the last 200 years?
Well, right now, if you just go to our website, IndianaLandmarks.org, you'll find it right on our landing page. We're featuring it right now. After that, we have a tab that's called Resources, where we've got all sorts of information helpful for people that are researching their houses or do-it-yourselfers, and it will be combined into that section. And I might also add, if somebody's interested in researching their house, because we do get a lot of questions about that, we already have an online historic research guide that's also in that resources section, so people can go there and get tips on how to research their house.
That's great to know. Thank you for mentioning that, to be sure. And thank you, Suzanne, for joining us on the program today to talk about this very interesting online guide that's now available out there on the Indiana Landmarks website.
Well, thanks so much. We hope people will visit the website as well as participate in one of Indiana Landmarks programs.
Suzanne Stannis is the Indiana Landmarks Director of Heritage Education and Information. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Northwest Indiana Forum is a nonprofit that is focused primarily on regional economic development and in help building all of the communities within the region. It's had a very busy 2019 and no doubt looking forward to a busier still 2020. Let's find out more. Heather Ennis is the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, and she's with us today. Heather, thank you for joining us on the program.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's been a very, very busy 2019, and why don't you give us the second, not the elevator pitch, because we have a little bit of time, but you could certainly go into a bit more detail and tell us more about how 2019 seems to have shaped up for the forum and certainly for all of the members of the organizations that help make up the forum.
Certainly. So it's been a very exciting year for Northwest Indiana, and this year, the forum teamed up with the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, and we did 24 outbound trips talking about Northwest Indiana with our local economic development organization partners, as well as the IEDC, NIPSCO, and others. We traveled all around the country and told the story of Northwest Indiana. We got an opportunity to meet with over 400 site selectors, companies, and brokers to tell the story, all around the country, as well as we made a trip to Canada as well. So Virginia, North Carolina, New York, Colorado, Seattle, Washington. So really traversed the map. So
I know one of the areas in particular that you focus on is, of course, not only stimulating business to bringing people that and organizations that maybe are not all that familiar with Northwest Indiana within Northwest Indiana becoming members of the community, so to speak, but also you talk too about expanding jobs. How does the forum fit into all of these different segments? And I guess maybe that's all part of this overall plan that has come out, and we've talked about before, about the program, which is called Ignite the Region.
Yeah, so Ignite the Region, our strategy for economic transformation is alive and well. So we kicked that off in 2018 and spent 2019 continuing that collaboration and working on implementation and transformation. There are about 123 initiatives on the Ignite the Region implementation matrix. We've got 112 of those that are currently in process, and 22% of them being completed. So it's pretty exciting. We're seeing things come not only get started, and the organizations around the region working hard together to get things done, but actually getting things done and moving things forward. We're really excited about the entrepreneurship and innovation team is working on an implementation of Impact Labs, which will be for not only for entrepreneurship, but intrapreneurship, as you were talking about, Chris, seeing the companies that are here grow. Mm-hmm. And so helping companies that are here be more innovative and figuring out how to remain relevant in their marketplace. So we're excited about that partnership. We're working with Center of Workforce Innovation on a 21st century talent region and really putting some numbers to the implementation matrix and what targets we're trying to hit. So it's been fun, a whirlwind of a year in 2019.
When you talk about some of the components that go into the Ignite the Region program, the multi-pronged approach, as I know that you all call it there at the forum, you talk about topics like infrastructure and placemaking. We've talked about some of the other major points about business development and entrepreneurship and talent in particular. That's where you're trying to get the Center for Workforce Innovations and be able to get them involved in bringing more jobs into the region, getting more people being able to be ready for those jobs. Where does infrastructure fit into the picture?
So So obviously, we have to have strong infrastructure in order to for companies that are here to grow, as well as to be able to attract companies. So there's very exciting things happening around the infrastructure at the port in Burns Harbor. We're seeing exciting developments and prospects that are continuously looking at the Gary Chicago Airport and the other airports that we have in the region. The rail infrastructure is a critical asset to the industrial development that looks at our region and that continues to grow here. So we try and keep a close eye on all of those things and make sure that we're aligning our resources to be best used for what we want our economic future to look like here in the region.
One of the things that gets brought up all the time, I'm sure, and you all cover it, and people, when you talk with folks outside Northwest Indiana, and if they're even remotely familiar with Northwest Indiana, about the great industrial legacy that we have, is on the other side of that industrial legacy is the environmental problems that come with all the heavy industry that we have had in the region. We've shed many of them, but and of course a lot of it's changing because of the changes in the 21st century. But how does the forum fit in with trying to help revive some of these areas that there used to be heavy industry into places that people can in turn use again with other types of business? And a lot of these, we've talked before about brownfields. How does this all fit into what's been done in 2019 and what you're hoping to do next year?
Yeah, so we were the recipient of an EPA grant this past year, along with our partners of NERPC and the Regional Development Authority. We jointly applied for funds from the EPA and have been awarded a grant to be able to help revitalize some of those properties. One of the largest problems for attracting investment to Northwest Indiana is that we don't have enough product ready. And so being able to redevelop those brownfields and remediate those properties to get them back on the tax rolls and get them cleaned up and better for the entire environment is a critical component for our success moving forward as a region.
What kind of input do you get from not only the businesses and the industries here in Northwest Indiana, but other organizations outside the region that maybe are interested in locating some type of business here, whether it's just a small outpost, so to speak, or a full-fledged factory? What kind of things do you hear from these people who want to maybe have a say in what the Northwest Indiana of the future is going to look like?
You know, it's so exciting. We spent some time in Seattle, as I said, at a tax preparedness conference, and different states got to give presentations to these tax incentive specialists that work with companies that are looking to locate in a certain area, or work directly for the company. You know, there are representatives there that are directly aligned with companies such as Honda or Lockheed Martin was there. So there were tax specialists, and as the states were talking, there was a site selector that was in the Michigan state presentation and kept referring to that it was a competition between Michigan and Indiana for this project, and the site selector kept referring to how competitive Indiana was for the project throughout the Michigan presentation. I felt a little bit badly for the Michigan folks, but it was really exciting to see that people are getting the story. People are understanding the opportunities for Indiana and how great our tax climate is and how wonderful our assets are. And then they continuously referred to Northwest Indiana and the infrastructure and what that means from a competitive standpoint for business. It turned out that Michigan ended up doing something extraordinary to close the deal, but it was kind of fun to listen to folks out from outside of the region during a presentation about another state talking about how awesome Indiana is. So the message is getting out there, and people are starting to realize that we've got great workers, great opportunity here in the region. As the heart of the Midwest, we really have an awful lot to offer, and we truly are the middle of everywhere. You know, our proximity to the East Coast is easy. The Great Lakes offer us great proximity to the world, and So we're really very fortunate where we're at.
I know you spent a lot of time in 2019 following through and fine-tuning the Ignite the Region initiative. What kind of goals does the Northwest Indiana Forum have for 2020?
So 2020 is going to be another exciting year. As I said, we did 24 trips this year going out and telling the story. We've got 42 active projects. We'd like that number for 2020 to be 50 active projects that we tackle for 2020. Again, we'll probably have somewhere in the 20 to 25 outbound trips where we work with partners to go out and tell the story of the region. We hosted 19 networking events here in the region. We'd like to do the same in 2020. I think that, you know, we're really seeing things come to fruition from the Ignite the Region plan, and really being able to put some more dollars towards those projects and to be able to raise funds for the things that are highest on the priority list there will be a big goal for 2020, and to continue to keep that momentum up. I mean, it was pretty interesting when we first started off to do this plan. Folks said, you're never going to get everyone to come together. You're never going to get the funding to be able to do it. The funding, I wouldn't say it came easily, but it came quickly, and people were excited about it. And then we had over about 500 people participate in the process, and people said, okay, well, now you've got a plan, and it's going to sit on the shelf. But people have actively been participating in it month after month and moving things forward. So it's been exciting, and I think 2020 will just be more opportunity to build on those. And so maybe we'll move from 22% complete on this plan to 50% complete. And well, I think there's a lot of exciting things that are coming closer and closer to fruition.
That well, certainly could happen, to be sure. Well, Heather, thank you for spending time and bringing 2019 in perspective and giving us a peek at how 2020 for the Northwest Indiana Forum is going to be. And we hope to have you back on here in the new year and talk more about it and have a chance to cover some more topics of interest here in Northwest Indiana economic development.
As always, thanks for having me, Chris.
Oh, you're welcome.
Very happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you. Heather Ennis is the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. Well, everybody likes a good sale, don't you? Well, here's an opportunity if you either have a tax-deferred retirement account maybe just a regular kind, or you've been looking into finding ways to make your plans for retirement, or you're getting close to retirement, an opportunity, a very rare window of an opportunity, actually, for investors to convert any tax-deferred retirement accounts into a tax-advantageous option, like a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k is coming up soon. Let's find out more. Here's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer with us to talk about it. Greg is always joining us here on Regionally Speaking. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, the Roth is a phenomenal instrument, vehicle that we utilize a lot. And essentially the tax advantages that are allowed in the industry are typically a deduction, deferred growth, or tax-free distribution. And you can't have all three. The Roth is the opportunity to have the deferred growth and tax-free distribution. So in today's tax environment with the current tax laws, it's something that needs to be considered in terms of not only contributions but potential conversions. As we call it right now, the taxes are kind of on sale.
Mm-hmm. How does the Roth conversion work?
Yeah, so essentially contribution is already satisfied. So a lot of folks sometimes get confused by the fact that I can only convert, you know, $6,500 or based on my income. Once you have the contribution satisfied, whether it went into a 401k, whether it went into an IRA, you can convert any portion of those dollars. Now, it's not always going to make sense for somebody to do it, but you're not limited at all in terms of how much you can convert in terms of the actual conversion.
Now, I guess that is the thing that maybe some people, you say, are concerned about because it is a tax hit, but you find a way to kind of work around that, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing is just understanding what those particular downsides are because it is a taxable event. So it will become income for that year that you do the conversion, and it's going to impact potential deductions, credits, exemptions, possible phase-outs, taxes of your Social Security, and could potentially even affect your Medicare premiums because those are means-tested. So in the analysis, those are all things that need to be considered. you know, does the good outweigh the bad? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's just going to depend in terms of, you know, the actual income plan that somebody has and how many assets they've accumulated in the pre-tax accounts.
I know you mentioned here about the fact that you have to kind of weigh things here, and I guess that is something you do have to consider, one of those questions that you do have to ask yourself before you convert to a Roth IRA, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the biggest thing to understand in today's current tax laws, it's probably the most preferential, not probably, it is the most preferential tax treatment I've experienced since being in the industry for whatever the last 27 years. Mm-hmm. The allowance of the tax brackets goes all the way up to over $300,000 for a married couple in terms of, you know, that discounted tax implication, where in previous years under the old tax laws, essentially anything over that $77,000 AGI was subject to a 25%, where everything now under 315 is subject to 24 or less, which is a huge variance from what the old tax laws used to be. And the opportunity may be limited for a couple reasons. Obviously, things can always change in terms of a new tax law coming out, but more importantly, it is scheduled to revert back to the old laws after 2025.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there maybe some other things to consider, too, when you do an IRA conversion like this?
Absolutely. There's a bunch of them in terms of, you know, whether it makes sense is when will we need the money, right? If we're going to use the money immediately, generally going to create less of an effect in terms of the overall planning as opposed to letting it potentially grow, you know, for a while in the tax advantage. And then the other things to really consider, you know, one is, you know, where will the money come from to pay the tax? Because you want to do the conversion, but it's usually not recommended to use those dollars then to pay the taxes. So we definitely need to understand, is there a resource to pay for the actual conversion so that, you know, we can pay the tax liability.
Right. I guess there are some things also, too, that you, as you say, some folks are just not really ready to make the change, to make the IRA conversion, are they? There's some things, I guess, that some people are maybe a little scared of.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things, right? You know, one is the unpredictable part of it is, you know, what will the future tax rates be? And that's just really going to be a judgment call. We don't know. Our tax is going to go potentially down farther than what they are. I mean, those are all just considerations you have to have in the process. If you're generally under the impression that, hey, these rates are low, I don't see them going lower and they're potentially going to rise, then that's going to lend more weight to the Roth conversion, where if you think that the rates could potentially go down, then obviously you don't want to convert at a higher rate. And, you know, a lot of people are just concerned, hey, can I still do it? If I convert it, can they change the rules? I mean, that's always something that can happen, but typically there's the grandfathering rule where, you know, once you actually do it, if they change the laws, it's usually moving forward, not retro back to people that may have done conversions already.
And do you have some people that maybe are just a little bit adverse because they're not sure they can be able to pay the income tax that they have to pay up front now?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's always something to consider. We tell people you need to pay it. You need to pay it timely at the conversion because you can't wait till the tax season to balance the books, so to speak. It has to be done at the time of the event. And if you don't have an opportunity to pay for that conversion, there's things that you can do to maybe do less conversions or take advantage of what you can. But that is definitely, Chris, part of the analysis in terms of whether or not it makes sense and whether or not to proceed forward with a Roth conversion.
Well, it sounds like it's one of these things that you have to take up with your financial advisor, number one, to see if it's the right move anyway. And then all these things you have to remember and do properly so that you take the best advantage.
Absolutely. I always tell people the federal tax code is anything but intuitive. So you need to understand what we call the marginal effects. You know, if I do this, create my income, it's not just the taxes from that income, but does it affect things like, you know, my deductions, my Social Security, you know, tax credits that I may have been eligible for that are eliminated. There's multiple things that come into play that could have adverse effects if you increase your income substantially by doing a conversion.
Well, Greg, thanks for the advice and the information and an opportunity for people to take a look, again, if they haven't done so lately, about their tax-deferred retirement accounts and see maybe if a Roth conversion might not be a bad idea. We appreciate the information today.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris.
Greg Hammers, our Northwest Indiana financial advisor. It's time now for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is local filmmaker Nick Mantis, who is always seen about town videotaping, as we used to call it,
yep.
something or other.
Videotaping.
And Nick, among you keep your finger in many pies. That's for sure. You do.
Yep.
You're a writer.
Yes.
And a filmmaker.
Correct.
Documentarian.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been working on a documentary about local author Gene Shepherd.
Yep.
How did that come about?
Well, in 2008, the downtown city council for Hammond, mm-hmm. Karen Maravilla mm-hmm. in particular, reached out to me and asked if I would volunteer some time and help them create a little video. 5-minute video connecting the city of Hammond mm-hmm. with the movie A Christmas Story.
Mm-hmm.
And I got excited about the idea because I knew a little bit about the movie and how popular it was and mm-hmm. somewhat a little bit of knowledge of the author and the writer of the movie, Gene Shepherd from Hammond, Indiana. And that's basically all I knew and what most people here in the region know about the movie, that's supposed to be Goblatz in the movie.
Right.
And, you know, Warren G. Harding is actually in Hessville. And I do think I hear Griffith, Indiana, mentioned in the movie. And so I was excited. And I said, sure, I'd do it. And so that's how it all started. And I heard a couple of clips on Gene Shepherd while I was doing the research for that 2008 video for them. And as the years went on, I couldn't get his voice out of my head. For some reason, I just kept thinking about him. The stories that I heard from him and some of the contributions that he had made to the media in general and a lot of things that people didn't know about him. So I said to myself, you know, why not step up and allocate my resources and, you know, do a documentary on this particular individual who just hasn't had the spotlight shined on him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I enjoy doing very much is putting the spotlight on people that otherwise wouldn't get any recognition. It's kind of my passion. And so I wrote Phil Potempa, letting him know that I was interested in doing the documentary. And he wrote an article, and it got a Google hit. And somebody, the book author on Gene Shepherd's only book, Eugene Bergman, Excelsior, The Enigma of Gene Shepherd, he contacted me and said, Nick, your timing's impeccable. In 2 weeks in New York, for the first time since Gene Shepherd passed away in 1999, they're going to honor him in a night of remembering Gene Shepherd, master storyteller, at the Paley Center, moderated by Jerry Seinfeld.
Hmm.
And so I went to the local library, and I still at this point didn't know much about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I grabbed as many CDs, audio tapes that I could. And then Sunday night, 3 in the morning, I started driving on a very cold January morning east on 80 to New York, and I put the first CD of Gene Shepherd. And 13 hours later, I honestly felt like somebody was sitting next to me in the passenger seat telling me these wonderful stories about growing up in Hammond, the Midwest, the Chicagoland area. And it was just a very enlightening moment for me in my life.
It wasn't originally called Christmas Story.
No, Gene Shepherd actually had another title for it. It evades me right now. But
and it was a part of a collection, I think.
Well, no, A Christmas Story, actually, the article itself was a Playboy article.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But then was it published in another, like a collection of his?
Yeah, there are some collections of his.
Since then.
Of course,
yeah,
yes.
Okay.
And then a lot of it, what basically Gene Shepherd did was he took a dozen stories of that were very popular that he told on the radio,
uh-huh.
wrote them in Playboy magazine each individually,
uh-huh.
and then he collected those and put them in a book called In God We Trust, All Others Pay
That's
Cash.
That's the one I'm trying to think of.
And in that book right there, they went ahead and made A Christmas Story from there.
Yeah, that's what I was. So now, when will the documentary be completed? We just have less than a minute to go.
Well, what makes this documentary very, very unique is that I'm going to have Gene Shepherd narrate his own life story, even though he's been dead for 20 years.
Okay, that's a trick.
And that's been the challenge that I have.
Uh-huh.
But it's coming together very well now that I've been listening to more and more of his shows, and I've uh-huh. been able to dedicate more time to that. But I'm planning on the summer of 2020.
Oh, great. So
yep.
soon. We
yep.
don't have to
very
wait too
soon.
Much longer.
Yep. Nope. And it's been very interesting, and a lot of people have been stepping forward, like Jerry Seinfeld to give me an interview, who got into comedy listening to Gene Shepard. And there's still some celebrities out there, some big names like Howard Stern and Steven Spielberg, who all have had contributions by Gene Shepard through their careers.
So Seinfeld got into comedy because he was inspired.
Mm-hmm.
By our own Gene Shepard.
That's right.
That's
how about
fantastic.
That? Yes,
okay.
It is.
Well, Nick, good luck with the documentary. That'll be great to see.
Thanks for having me, John, and I very much enjoy the show.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear more comments and conversations on Eye on the Arts on our website right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in again next Monday here during Regionally Speaking and all through Lakeshore Public Radio on Mondays for Eye on the Arts Conversations. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up tomorrow, we have a special Regionally Speaking featuring some of the candidates who want to succeed Congressman Pete Visclosky in Congress, the candidates for the 1st District seat here in Northwest Indiana. They'll be competing in the Democratic primary coming up in May. On Thursday, we also have the Best of Reporters Roundtable Thursday.